are listening to WWBC Coco, Merritt Island, 1510 AM, as well as W234BI Coco, Rockledge, 94.7 FM, W264AS, Rockledge, Melbourne, Palm Bay, Indian Atlantic, Indian Harbor Beach, Satellite Beach, 100.7 FM, and W260CL, Coco, 99.9 FM.
Hello, space and treasure coast. This is Sita Biggie on Viewpoint with Sita and Friends, right here on AM 1510 WWBC, FM 94.7, 99.9, 100.7, and can also be heard on the World Wide Web.
That's right, at 1510wwbc.com, and you also can download the app no matter where you are in the world by searching for WWBC, either in the Google Play Store or in the Apple App Store.
And I have to say, to our sponsors, to our listeners, to people who support our show, we appreciate you. We are so grateful. And there are ways that you could download our show from right on the website. And my other co-host, Samantha, is here. Samantha Nazario is here, and she's going to tell you how.
We've gone and done the step-by-step for you, so you're going to do what Paul said. Go to 1510 WWBC. You're going to click on the on-demand button, click on the calendar, select the date and year of the show you want to listen to. All our shows are archived there as well, so you can listen to as far back as you like. The fourth step, you're going to hit Viewpoint with Zita and Friends, and then you are welcome to listen to any show you'd like. If you'd like to listen to today's, or if you missed a show from a month ago, help yourself, and we look forward to you enjoying the shows. Thank you.
Yeah, you know, and it's always nice that people who don't have time can go back in the archive on the show and listen to a show.
At their leisure. I do it with my mom all the time because she doesn't want to sit in the car, so I let her listen to it when we're home.
Right, and it really helps a lot, right?
Yeah, she loves the Charlie Crist one.
Yeah, and so Paul, I'm so grateful to Paul that he actually hits that button that says record, and he also has a CD for us at times that Ellen has, and when our website is back up and running, we'll put it on there. So our lineup today, our friend Kim Meredith is here. Yay,
hello.
Kim.
Hi.
Kim, we're so proud of you. Kim is going to be starting her own show on WWBC.
What's cooking
in the 3-2-1. I love it.
3-2-1. And, you know, this is how great ideas come to life, by all of us working collectively to help each other and share knowledge and our experience. And I'm so grateful that you and Paul were able to come to a conclusion on what day and what time. So Samantha, take it away. Let's advertise for our friend Kim Meredith.
We're going to make sure that we advertise for what's going on in the 3-2-1 every single week on our Facebook page. And it's so exciting to see. I love to see women empower women. And of course, we're so grateful to Paul for opening up the studio to Kim and giving her this opportunity to talk about the importance of food and all the love
food.
That goes into
food.
Who
doesn't
love
like talking about
what's
food,
cooking,
right?
What's cooking in the
so that's right. So, you know, we sit in the studio every week, and it's an extension of me. It's an extension of our living room. And we talk about kitchen table topics, things that are going on around the state, right here in Brevard and all over the world and the nation. And apparently our listeners like it because they're still renewing their contracts to advertise with us. And some of our sponsors will help us pay for shows for our nonprofits and people that are calling in to speak about a topic that someone likes. And, of course, today we have two people calling in. We have an author by the name of Sarah Hanks. She's calling in, and, boy, she's written some really good books. She's going to talk to us about her books on mercy, right? It's Mercy's Song.
Mercy's Song.
And series. I love it.
Right. It's a series, right? And so she's on the phone. And our second guest is going to be a woman by the name of Wendy Dormel. It's a beautiful name.
If we're wrong, she'll correct us.
Dormel. I think that's how it says, right? Mm-hmm. And so she is the president of the Orange County Classroom Teachers Association. And we're going to have a nice chat with Wendy about COVID-19, mask, who's opting out, who's not opting out, why they're not opting out. And, of course, I did get my booster shot being a nurse. Of course, everybody knows that I am pro-vaccines. But anyway, so on the phone, we have our first guest, and her name is Sarah Hankson. Sarah, thank you for taking the time to call in on our show here in Cocoa, Florida, Viewpoint with Sita and Friends. So good morning.
Thank
good afternoon.
Thank you so much for having me.
Girl, good afternoon. Thank you so much.
It's great to talk to you.
Yes. So what state are you actually calling in from?
Missouri. I'm in St. Charles, Missouri, which is right next to St. Louis.
You hear that, Samantha?
Nice. We've had quite, I've been across that bridge.
Yeah, we've had quite a few guests that called in from Missouri. I can never say Missouri.
Missouri.
No, not Missouri. Missouri.
Missouri.
You know that movie, Misery? I don't know why Kathy Bates always comes to mind. Oh, my God. No wonder our show is fun, unscripted, educational, and informative, because now we're going to be talking about Kathy Bates and a bad nurse.
And we're teaching Zita the difference between Misery and Missouri.
Missouri. It's a Trinidadian accent. You know, I gave up making excuses for my Trinidadian accent. I just can't be bothered anymore. I'm too old for that. So, Sarah, you're a dynamic human being. You've got your family. You're the author of the novels Mercy Will Follow Me, Mercy's Song, Mercy's Legacy, which releases this winter. You are a professional writer, an author. You devote yourself to teaching and the children's ministry, including writing in Sunday school. And you have 8 children. You do have a husband, which is great. 8 kids. She needs the help.
Yes.
She needs it, right?
Thank God. Yes.
And you, like us, you have these dreams. You want to live on the beach in a cabin, or you want to live in the woods in a cabin. But right now, you're jammed in together in St. Louis, Missouri, and you have a lot of earplugs.
Yes.
I need it. Yep. So let's get started about... you know, you strike me as a leader. You know, leaders, when they lead, people follow. And I think by writing this book, you are taking on a role where all of us can learn what you learned from watching one of the, you said you were at one of the, was it a march, or you just watched what happened to a young man in your town. So talk to us a little bit about your story and how you started writing about these books.
Sure. Well, Mercy Will Follow Me in particular, that was birthed in Ferguson. So with Mike Brown, the uprising that happened at his sentencing, we lived about 10 minutes away. And so our city was burning down around us. And it was just unprecedented. And I'm a white woman. I have one biracial adopted child, but I'm a white woman, and I had honestly didn't have a clue. I didn't know. I thought, you know, well, this is all, it's all over now. You know, haven't we all moved on from this? I was pretty clueless, but my city was burning down around me. But what most people don't know, and what the news didn't show, is that there was a tent that various churches from the community put up, and people were just worshiping in this tent. People were coming together, all races and all ethnicities were coming together in this tent. And I went down there, and we saw amazing things taking place, and people coming together, and people just being healed and reconciled, and all of this wonderful things taking place. That didn't make the news cameras.
Yeah, that's why cable news sometimes is not good for our psychological mind, because the cable news shows you, just like we see what's going on Facebook, what they want you to see to increase their ratings. But I didn't see no tent with people praying with Bibles and from all different faiths and walks of life. So I'm glad that we have you, Sarah Hanks, to tell us about that scene and how it affected you. So talk to us a little bit. Your book was born in that tent.
Yes, it was. Yeah, I went up and got prayer. I had written some books, had self-published a couple books before, but at that point in my life, I'd actually gone through the season of being really sick, and I didn't feel like I had anything left to write. I didn't feel like I had anything left in me, but I got prayer, and I just felt this story come to life inside of me. And I'm a kind of person, I'm not afraid for controversial topics. I'm not afraid to kind of walk into that. And I'm like, you know what? I want to start a conversation. people of color are a lot more comfortable talking about racial issues than white people are. We are not used to it. We don't have to. We can go through our lives and not talk about these things. It makes us uncomfortable. But we need to. We need to have conversations. And we need to go outside of our comfort zones because our worlds are too small. If we stay in a little white bubble with people that look like us and think like us and are just like us, we're missing out on so much. And we need to reach beyond that. So that's what I really wanted to do with this series of books, is just encourage people who are like me. You know, if you didn't have a clue, if you don't know, if you're scared, if you're like, well, I don't know, I don't really know how to reach out to people who are different than me, and I'm afraid that I'm going to get rejected, or I'm afraid, you know, what are they going to think of me, or I'm just not sure, you know, how. Well, let's just open up the conversation and let's see where it goes.
Wow, Sarah, that's amazing, and I live in a place where you are right. If you've had the luxury of, you know, being born white, color's not something that you usually discuss, so I find myself very intrigued with your books. What themes do you address in the book series?
Okay, so they are time flips. And so what that means for people who aren't familiar is that there's a historical timeline and then there's a modern day timeline. And it kind of flips back and forth. You might have a chapter or two in the historical and then it'll go back to the modern day. So the historical timeline is about a mulatto enslaved girl. And then the modern-day storyline follows both a white woman, Natasha, and then a black male, DeAndre, which I had a lot of help with from listening to people of color and learning from them in writing that story. But it deals a lot with racial reconciliation, and it deals with healing and forgiveness. And there's some underlying themes of the juxtaposition between justice and mercy, and what does that look like? And what does it look like if you're choosing between loyalty and freedom? What does that look like? And so there's a whole lot of different themes as you go throughout the novels, but those are the big ones.
Right. And so in your novel, there are three main characters. And of course, I wish we had 10 hours to sit and talk to you about these books. But I want to hear a little bit about Natasha, DeAndre, and I always forget the third character.
Mercy.
So, main one. So, talk to us about the three of them, because Natasha is like us. She seemed to have it all. And then, boom, something happened. So, talk to us about that.
Yes. Natasha seems to be, in a great place. She's got money. She's in a place of, you know, pretty privileged lifestyle, but there's something, you know, missing in her heart and in her life. And then she goes through this major crisis, and she finds herself pregnant, and her child is biracial. And she has been, just in a white bubble, kind of like myself. She doesn't have any friends of color. She doesn't have any relationships with people of color. She ends up finding healing and meaning in a community of black people in this beautiful black church. She was drawn to this church because of the stained glass windows in the city, and she finds herself just welcomed and enveloped by this community of people, and she finds healing there. DeAndre's story, it will pull on your heartstrings. You know, some people like, oh, I love him. Oh, I can't stand him. Oh, I love him again. You know, kind of, he goes back and forth, but he's a character that you can really relate to.
Right.
And Mercy's.
Oh, go ahead. Yeah, so tell us about Mercy.
Mercy, she was torn from her mother when she was just a young child. And this whole story is just her trying to deal with that separation and her longing for her mother, but also trying to find her place in the world as a very light-skinned, enslaved person. And I dove into the slave narratives of enslaved people I probably read for, you know, over a year before I even started writing her story, of all of the Federal Writers Project and Harriet Jacobs and Frederick Douglass and all of those slave narratives to really get a good feel for her story. And it it is just one that is very inspiring and very moving.
So are we to, then are we saying then that DeAndre Natasa's child was Mercy? No.
No, no.
Because you go
because really Mercy takes place during slave time.
Oh, you go back and forth. It's a historical back and forth. Yeah.
Wow. So you kind of find out how it really ties together. You Bethany Mercy was a relative of Bethany's. So Bethany is Natasha's friend that she makes at the church, and Bethany gives Natasha.
Oh, she explains the journal. Okay.
So when she walked into that church, she got a wealth of knowledge.
History.
She got an education. She got history. She learned about the past. And then we get the story about this mulatto enslaved girl from that. And it's amazing because, you know, how many people who are privileged don't step out of their box to learn about another culture, another religion, another place. And when you do, this is what happened. Your mind opens up and expands. And you could literally sit there and write an entire book about what you just discovered.
I think your topic of writing, especially for Natasha, I think it's amazing because you're right. It's very hard for someone who has never lived as a colored person to bring a biracial child into the world. You have to teach them other things that, you know, you don't have to teach a regular child. You have to let them know you can't do this, you can't do that. They pull you over, put your hands up. You know, we live by an entirely different set of rules. So I think it's amazing that you took the time to research and really bring those characters to life.
Yes, she did. So Sarah, you do an amazing job of linking the historic past to modern day problems. And we still see those problems exist. Right now, we see racial inequalities. We still see racism playing out. We still see people, whether politicians or regular people, using skin color to divide. While you were writing the book, were you thinking about these today, modern time, and slavery? Because slavery, to me, was the worst thing that ever happened in our world. And some people see what's happening today as remnants of slavery because of institutionalized racism and unconscious and conscious bias. So when you were writing the book, were you thinking about that as well?
I will tell you that it, like I said, when Ferguson happened, I was clueless. It didn't start to really make sense until I dove into the history of slavery. And when I, you know, we weren't taught this in school. I mean, it was lightly brushed over. But when I really started digging into it and really reading it, I was like, oh my gosh, this makes sense. Like, no wonder they're burning these buildings down. Like, no wonder. Like, it clicked. Something in me clicked. And yes, it's all connected.
Right.
It's definitely all connected.
Right. And we're not saying it's okay to burn buildings down. You were just saying at that point in time, because of course the best way to move forward is through communication and education like you have done. But I understand what you're saying. You understood the pain of what these people were feeling at that time.
Hundreds of years of oppression.
Yes. That's what you understand.
Right.
So who are you hoping to reach with your stories?
Well, as a white woman who writes, my genre is technically Christian fiction. I'm hoping that people outside of that would be able to read the book and enjoy it. But I know that mostly white women will read my book. I mean, that's technically that's statistically who is going to read my book. And that's good because most people who are where, you know, I was before I read the book, if they see a book written by a person of color, there's something in them that says, oh, that's not for me. And so they won't pick up a book written by a person of color. And that's just, you know, something maybe that society has kind of ingrained in them or an unconscious bias. And I hope that my book will be a bridge because what I really want and what we really need to move forward is to be able to learn from people of color about people of color. But, you know, we're not all there yet.
Yeah.
So I'm hoping that my book can be a bridge so that then, you know, people feel more comfortable in reading a book by a person of color.
You're brutally honest the way you speak. And because of that, I respect you and I admire you because it comes from your heart. And you have woven such a tale of redemption and pain. And it's a painful book, but yet still, I love the name when you say mercy will follow me. I mean, that in itself is as Christian as can be, right? Because I work in a nursing home, right? And I hear the older people always say, have mercy. Or, you know, or they always say, bless your heart, or mm-hmm. something like that, you know? And then I know the Christian. So talk a little bit about the book and how you feel about the name that you chose.
Yeah, well, mercy will follow me. That's from a verse in the Bible that says, surely his goodness and mercy will follow me all the days of my life. And so even through the horrific, terrible circumstances that Mercy goes through in the historical storyline and Natasha goes through in the modern day storyline, there is a thread of hope. You know, I don't leave the readers, you know, depressed and dejected at the end. There's a thread of hope in it that they're gonna be okay in the end.
Yeah.
There's hope and there's healing and there's freedom through it all.
Right. And you touch a little bit about the decision making that a woman goes through to keep a child. And that to me was one of the points in your book that, like you said, the Christian audience would like, because you know, we hear so much about abortion and adoption and women of, you know, making pro-choice, pro-life. Talk to us a little bit about that painful choice that the mother had to make at that point to carry a child of a black man.
Yes, and it was not, for Natasha, it was not an easy answer. You know, for Natasha and her whole family, they identified as pro-life always. And then here she is in this pregnancy that she never could have conceived of. And she doesn't know.
Yeah.
Now her family that she has always thought was pro-life, they've always voted pro-life or whatever, now they're saying, okay, we think you should have an abortion. Now she's not sure. She's not sure what to do. So it's not always an easy, you know, check-the-box decision. But through it all, in the end, she does decide that she wants to parent this child. But it's you know, not a quick check-the-box, you know, easy answer for her in this novel.
What a heart-wrenching decision for her to have to make. And yeah, you know, having to grapple with if to keep the child or not, and then the hypocrisy of those
the
who are
family.
Pro-life, right? Now some are saying, well, it's okay, you can get rid of it, right? But she kept this child, and the child grew up and started questioning being black or white, freedom or loyalty. And your book is going to make all of us think. So how have you changed as a human being writing this book? I'm sure your characters came alive to you as you wrote the book, and they were sitting right there in your house with the 8 children.
Oh, absolutely. I say that I have imaginary friends, and that's perfectly normal.
Yes.
Because I do. I went on a research trip to just Chicago, where DeAndre lives in the third book, and I was seriously looking around the corner expecting to see him. I'm like, where is he?
Yeah.
I had to keep reminding myself, he's not real, sir. He's not real. But I do. I feel like they're real to me. And the amount of research that I put into book two goes into the whole prison system, and the research that I put into that. And there's a whole interview on my website, too, about prison ministry and the prison system, if anybody's interested in that. But that was just so eye-opening to me.
Mm-hmm.
And just talking with these men and hearing their stories, I don't know how I could not
be changed.
It's all about empathy. And that's what hearing other people's stories does, is awakens empathy. And fiction, you know, that's what fiction does. It awakens our empathy. And you hear it said, you know, to walk a mile in somebody else's shoes. And that's what we do.
Absolutely.
Whether it's a true story or it's a fictional story, we're walking a mile in somebody else's shoes. And it just expands our hearts.
Yes, it does.
It helps us to be able to relate to other human beings better. It helps us to be able to love well.
Thank you, Sarah. For our listeners here on Viewpoint with Zita and Friends, we have author Sarah Hanks on with us. She's discussing her books, Mercy Will Follow Me and Mercy's Song. Sarah, can you tell people where we can find you and where can we find these books?
Yeah, my website is sarah-hanks.com. That's Sarah with a slash Hanks.com. And on there, you can find my books. You can find them on Amazon. And you can find me on Facebook or Instagram as author Sarah Hanks.
Well, I feel like you're sitting right here with me in the studio, and I'm going to be waiting with bated breath for your next book. I am going to buy the series, though, because I enjoy reading books that take me back into history, because I do believe that all of us learn from history, life experiences, past mistakes. Hell, we learn by just sitting here and talking to each other and learning in a tent like you did. So I will talk to you after the show. Thank you, Sarah Hanks, for taking the time to call in on Viewpoint with Zita and Friends. And we'll be right back after these messages with our second guest.
Yes, we will.
Portions of Viewpoint with Zita and Friends is sponsored by the friends and family of Zita Begee, author of 18 Brothers and Sisters and founder of Simply Zita Skincare, and these great sponsors. Cloud 9 Mattress and Furniture is a family-owned furniture dealer featuring the best and most affordable brands. They offer all servicing for free. The delivery, setup, and home, removal of old furniture, and warranty. Work with a reputable and experienced local business as they strive for excellence with their customers. Scotty's been in the mattress and furniture business for 32 years. You can shop online, call, or stop into the showroom to place an order. They are conveniently located inside the Merritt Square Mall and service all of Brevard County in Central Florida. Super savings sale happening now. That's Cloud 9 Mattress and Furniture, 321-459-2473. Visit them on the web at cloud9furniture.com. Again, 321-459-2473 for Cloud 9 Mattress and Furniture. When you need medical care and need it fast, MedFast Urgent Care is faster and less expensive than emergency rooms. MedFast is open 7 days a week, now with 13 locations, including one in Volusia County. With so many MedFast Urgent Care centers, there is a MedFast near you. MedFast offers top quality care that is close by, and the number is easy to remember. That is 321-MEDFAST. You just call 321-MEDFAST. No one wants to wait in an emergency room for hours and get even sicker when you get the high bill. What you want is medical care fast. That's why you call MEDFAST, where most patients are seen and treated in less than an hour. So when you need medical care fast, call 321-MEDFAST. MedFast. Located in Titusville, Florida, Dixie Crossroads has been serving great tasting seafood, char grilled steaks, prime rib, chicken, fresh salads, and their famous corn fritters for over 31 years. The menu features the very best local shrimp and fish from Port Canaveral and ranges from low cost sandwiches and baskets to high end seafood combos. Visit this Florida favorite at 1475 Garden Street in Titusville. That's Dixie Crossroads, 321-268-5000. 321-268-5000, or visit them on the web at dixiecrossroads.com. Champion Home Healthcare, keeping your loved one happy, healthy, and at home. Available at 321-306-2551. Once again, 321-306-2551. Champion Home Healthcare is ACHC accredited and licensed, Medicare certified, and a TRICARE provider. Champion Home Healthcare, 306-2551.
There's something special about the place we call home. It's the place we live our lives, spend time with family and friends, and make our own. At St. Francis Reflections Hospice, we consider it a privilege to care for you wherever your home may be. We put our hands, hearts, and skills into providing high-quality hospice care in your home. To learn more about how we reflect life, love, and compassion, visit www.reflectionslsc.org.
Welcome back, dear listeners. This is Sita Biggie on Viewpoint with Sita and Friends right here in sunny Cocoa, Florida. We are heard on AM 1510 on WWBC, FM 94.7, 99.9, 100.7, and all over the world.
On 1510, WWBC.com, and on the WWBC app.
And Samantha will tell our listeners and our sponsors and anybody else who's interested how to listen to our shows, because our website is under construction. It was hacked.
Yes. But thanks to Paul's wonderful efficiency, you go to the WWBC 1510 app. You select the calendar date. You select the Viewpoint with Zita and Friends button. And you can actually see our archived shows, for I believe the ladies have been with Paul's station now 6 or 7 years. And all the wonderful shows are there. So if you can't hear us live, please always feel free to tune in.
Right. And while we wait for our second guest, Wendy DeRamo, to call in, she is the president of the Orange County Classroom Teachers Association, and that's what I call good karma, how her and I met. We both met during the Hillary Clinton campaign, and we both supported our different political candidates, and we became good friends on Facebook, and, you know, it's great. And then I get people to call in. So for our listeners who are tuning in, we have our friend Kim Meredith sitting in with us.
Hello.
Kim's going to be starting her own show. Kim, I'm going to give you a minute or two before Wendy calls in to tell our listeners
pressure,
a little bit about your show and when it's starting. The name, the time, the date, and how excited you are. Yeah.
What's cooking in the 3-2-1? We're, you know, it's about breaking bread and brevard. I mean, we're going to talk about food, of course, and but a lot comes with that food. We're gonna have we've got a great shows already lined up. Of course, for Thanksgiving, we're gonna do turkey drives, and we're gonna be talking to people who are locals feeding the locals, and we're gonna try to have every week we're gonna have a different restaurant owner or somebody from a restaurant in house and talking. We've got all kinds of things lined up. All kinds of things coming up.
Well,
so
good. Well, good conversations normally happen when there's good food
and at the dinner table,
right?
You know, even in a restaurant, you sit down, conversation. So we've got a lot coming up. I'm really excited, and thank you for being my mentor and getting me to this point. And,
well, we're proud of you starting
your
own show.
You're going to be on my show.
Yes, yes.
Well,
I will
cooking
do,
in the 3-2-1.
You know what? I may have to put in to take a day off to come, because your show is on, yeah. I'm on a Thursday, and I work Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday at the nursing home. But anyways, yes, when you talk about food, I always remember back in Trinidad when we were sitting on the back stairs where it was, you know, we had 18 children in our family, and at any given time, a few of the grown ones were married and gone. But there were like 10 left, and we would sit on the back step and have our plates on our lap, and it would be all of us sitting there with our plates and our long braids eating on the back step. And so, yes, eating and food
absolutely
always brought us together. We were poor, but poverty makes you stronger.
Well,
yes,
we're
it does.
Help people,
and it gives you a lot of courage.
Build a pantry in their house of things that when somebody just stops by, I always call it cooking in pajamas 101.
Ooh.
You got to be ready if somebody knocks at that door, because bring them into the kitchen, set them down.
Our show, Viewpoint with Sita and Friends, is so great. We don't have food here, but we talk about kitchen table topics.
She's making me hungry, though.
Absolutely.
And I'm Puerto Rican, so my go-to is corned beef and white rice.
One of the things we talk about on our show is education. Public education, clean environment. We talk about financial literacy. We talk about home ownerships. We talk about food. We talk about anything that helps a human being to be loved, appreciated, be respected, and just live on this earthly journey called life, right?
Yes.
And so one of the people that I met that thinks a little bit like myself is my friend Wendy Doramel.
Domal.
How much
do
you
need
to tell us?
You can write that for us, Wendy.
Wendy is the president of the Orange County Classroom Teachers Association, and she's taking time from her busy day to call in, and she's going to tell us exactly how to pronounce that last name.
Yes.
Wendy, thank you for taking the time to call in. You're on air, so go ahead.
Oh, thank you. My name is Wendy Dormal. You got it right.
Dormal.
Told you.
Uh-huh, I got it. So, you know what? I've been following you on Facebook, and I was driving in my car the other day, and I heard you on NPR, and I was so proud of you because you were talking about education, and we all know that what exactly is education, right? Education is that making sure that every child everywhere has a quality education, no matter where their zip code is, and they're safe and secure in the learning environment. And you reflect that in the way you speak, Wendy. So talk to us a little bit about yourself a little bit and your position with the Orange County Teachers Association. Teachers Association.
Right. I've been honored to have been a teacher for over 30 years. I taught in Florida and in Micronesia. So I've taught everything from kindergarten, art, college, and always have taught with the theory that we want to make a future citizen, a citizen at the present moment, and make someone who carries themselves, not just educated, but as a loving and compassionate member of society into the world.
Right. And you know, teachers shape our lives. I mean, every child remembers that one teacher that stands out above the rest. And for me, it's always been a teacher by the name of Miss Philomena in Trinidad, a Christian Indian teacher that cared about my mother and her children and us not having shoes to wear on our feet to come to school, not having socks, but saying to my mother, how can I help you with your children? And how can I teach them? And that stands out to me because those were the days when my mom needed compassion and somebody to care about us and our education. And I just have the utmost respect for teachers. So I've been listening to you, and I see now that a lot of parents are having to make decisions about opt out, if to wear a mask, if not to wear a mask. We have a governor in our state who has made wearing a mask so political. Talk to us a little bit. Bring us up to speed about what is happening with the mask mandate and the opt-out situation.
Sure. So in Orange County Public Schools, we finally have a school board who agreed that we have to have universal masking. We have kids who are 12 and under who don't have the ability to get vaccinated. We have employees and students who have medical conditions and need to be protected. And we know that the Delta variant even has affected and people who were vaccinated and they become very sick. So as educators, as school boards, we have a responsibility to provide not just an education, but a safe and healthy learning and teaching environment in which that education takes place. So it's really important to us that there's a mask mandate until children under 12 can be vaccinated and until the positivity rate goes to a level that the CDC says it's okay, you don't have to wear a mask. We hear about herd immunity, and we're not reaching that in our state because we're not pushing vaccines as much as we could. We're not pushing the mask mandate. And we see our schools are really overcrowded right now because, of course, everyone had to come back to face-to-face learning so that there's not the ability to have that social distancing we had last school year.
Yeah. And sometimes you wonder what has happened to parents, right? Because when a woman becomes pregnant and they decide to keep their baby, they go to the doctor regularly for checkups. They get worried for the slightest thing. If a blood sugar is elevated, if something in the urine is wrong, they're so concerned about that child and that baby and whatever. And now the kid is born, and the scientist is telling you if you put a mask on, you can protect the child from contracting the virus or bringing it home to a grandparent and protecting each other. What do you think happened to parents that their common sense is just gone out the window because of wearing a mask?
I just, I looked at our school board meetings where there's so much disruption, there's rudeness. It's incredibly crazy now. And I think this is all political. A lot of the people that attend the school board meetings that are saying they're against mask mandates, against vaccines, are following the political agenda of our former president. They wear his shirts and slogans, and they're following our governor, who, quite frankly, has a political agenda that he pushes over the well-being and safety of children, employees in schools, and every citizen. So it's really disappointing. It's a polarized atmosphere when I think of wearing a mask as a sign of compassion and caring for fellow human beings and members of our society. I don't think anyone thinks wearing a mask forever is a wonderful thing, but it's an act of compassion.
Right, yes.
And caring.
Well, you know, being a nurse myself, you know, a lot of us, when we're, the TV's on in the patient's rooms or in the day room, and we hear the governor talking and Governor Ron DeSantis speaking and using scare tactics and bullying and talking about the mask mandate for the children and the teachers, we all shake our head, because the thing is, we all need to fight this pandemic together and reset the economy. It's a no-brainer. Everybody should be doing the right thing. So, I mean, as a nurse myself, I got vaccinated. I got my first shot in December, my second one in January of this year, and I just got my booster, and I'm fine. And you're absolutely correct. Nobody wants to wear a mask forever. But it is heartbreaking to see our little patients come out of their rooms in their wheelchairs, and they have to wear their mask if they come out of their rooms. So I wonder if the governor understands that by delaying masks in schools and not having a positivity rate where we want it, he's actually hurting the most precious of all, the elderly as well.
That is so true. And I know that we've seen teachers who have caught COVID at school and were on an incubator in the hospital, came out of the hospital, went back in the hospital with pneumonia, and now are on long-term leave. We've seen teachers who have severe memory loss. I have a relative who caught COVID and had severe heart implications from that. And we know that the innocent children, you don't even want them to get sick, you know, never mind thinking of, could they die from this? So it's not even in my mindset to understand a governor or education commissioner who is so callously saying, you know, we have the right to opt out. There's parents' rights. No one has the right to make someone sick. And even if it's one person, that's one person too many. So I don't understand that mindset. I don't understand the Surgeon General's rule that would allow parents to decide if their child who tests positive and is asymptomatic could attend school. I think it's absolutely reckless and dangerous. And I don't know what's happened to our society that we've become so callous and uncaring to fellow human beings. But it is a message of callousness when you promote you have the right to make another person sick.
Absolutely. Mr. Rall, this is Samantha Nazario. It's a pleasure to make your acquaintance. I've seen you on the news many times. You're definitely one of those women forces of nature that I like to call them. I'm curious here because I am part of a committee here with our local Brevard public school system. It's called the Diversity Committee. And I'm curious as to, it's a two-part question for you. Why do you think there's so much anger? And why is there such little transparency when it comes to our COVID dashboards about race? Every school board divides everything else by race. Why is the dashboards not showing that?
I think, well, you know, our union took our school district to court last year to demand transparency because they refused to disclose even how many COVID cases there were and what schools or work sites they were at. And we felt to protect kids and to protect teachers and the communities and families that they go home to at the end of the day, we needed that information. I think that the state and the school boards are very protective of that information, and I quite frankly don't understand it. I think it's very ironic because we have school systems that are all about data, 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 and they look at kids as data points, you know. So I don't understand why they're not sharing that information. We know that minority children and children who are less economically they're economically
deprived.
Challenged.
Yes.
Yes. Thank you.
They're deprived. Yeah.
Yeah. For getting COVID or having illness, we've seen that even before COVID with dental care and eye care and other medical treatments. So I would say that we need to do everything we can to educate families on the importance of getting vaccinated, the importance of keeping your child masked, having your child stay home if they're exhibiting symptoms of illness to protect other people.
Yeah, I mean, we just have to care. I mean, it makes no sense that a parent have to leave work and go home to pick up a child who has COVID at school or been exposed to COVID because people decided that they were going to not wear a mask because now the job doesn't have employees. Somebody else have to pick up the slack. Nurses are working overtime. I can only speak about my profession. You know, nurses are having to pick up the slack. Nurses' aides are calling in. And once one person is infected, the other ones have to stay home. So it's a domino effect. And, you know, I read recently where it says that one out of 500 American children have lost a mommy or daddy or grandparent who took care of them to COVID-19. And I wonder if the governor of the state of Florida is paying attention to the children who are now orphaned because of the political stance that he took and others like him took to make getting a vaccine political, to make wearing a mask political, and to make interfering in our school system with the most vulnerable and the future of our world and our country, the children, mm-hmm. to make that such an issue. So, I mean, what do you think happened with our country that conspiracy theories took, I mean, it just grew? What happened, Wendy, with our country?
I think that it's really scary that people follow someone, a leader, almost as a cult.
Yes.
And that's what I saw with Trump. That's what I'm seeing with DeSantis. I listen to the anti-maskers at the school board meeting, and I'm scared. I'm scared for our future and our country, and I think we need to really look at what we're doing. Elections have consequences. And I know that's very trite to say, but we really need to think about who sets policy, who makes laws, and what's happening in our local school districts, in our schools, and in our communities, states, and in our nation. We have to start thinking about compassion and love again instead of just fighting with each other and polarizing and taking sides. We should all be on the side of let's work together to end the pandemic right now. Let's work together to help each other. And as you said, our children are our future.
Yeah, I mean, you see politicians wrangling in Washington, D.C. about technology and Facebook and ads. And that is important. But nothing is as important as protecting the children in our schools and our teachers and the support staff because they are the future of this nation. And I often
and they're
wonder,
the ones dying.
So yes, and so Wendy, when you walk into a school, what are some of the things you're hearing from the teachers, the challenges that they're facing with the children who are not wearing masks, with the angry parents, and with the opt out?
So now we have a universal mask mandate. Our school district went against the governor's direction. Thankfully, it was very late. So, unfortunately, we have had over 7,300 positive COVID cases in August, September, and just the couple weeks of October. And that's more than the whole last school year. And it's because we didn't have a mask mandate from the beginning. So we've been hearing from teachers that it's very challenging. Last year was challenging, but this year is even more challenging. Our school district would not sign an agreement with us that recognized CDC recommended protections, such as cleaning and disinfecting, social distancing, that type of thing that goes along with mask mandates. So we have teachers who are worried, especially teachers who are on chemotherapy or have other medical conditions or have a family member with medical conditions. It's very challenging for them. I think there's only about 400 some students who have medical excuses for not wearing a mask. But you still see students who want to pull their mask down, and teachers are worried about disciplining them because, of course, we don't have that agreement that we had last year. But it is challenging to teach in school during a pandemic when you have 200,000 students crammed into classrooms. It's a true challenge, and I think the teachers are heroes, and I really admire what they do every day because they're making the impossible possible, and they put the kids first every single day that they're in that classroom.
That's correct. And you know what I don't like? I mean, of course, Governor Ron DeSantis can say what he wants. He's the governor. But sometimes the way he says things, it's all about coding. Like, he'll say something like, well, I don't think you can override the rights and decisions of parents. And there's that word, rights, that he's appealing to a certain base. And yeah, and it makes for a really bad situation, because then you're telling parents that their rights cannot be overridden. It's not about it. The parent doesn't have the right to infect other people's children.
And you're also raising another generation of kids that are going to feel it's my right to not have to listen to
that
you.
That word right sometimes it says, you know, it has a lot of meaning, you know?
I think that what we need to do as a society and what we need to do as educators is take that word rights and replace it with responsibility.
Yes,
what are my rights, but also what are my responsibilities? And they have to go hand in hand. You can't just have rights that ride over someone's other rights, you know.
Yes.
Like your right to life. That's craziness.
But she has not had strep throat. She has not been out. You know, usually in a semester in the past, she'd miss maybe 7 days. She hasn't missed one day. And I blame it on that mask. I think that mask has helped her to not get the common cold, not get the flu, and above all, COVID. But it has kept her safe. So I'm a parent not complaining about that mask.
Right. And my granddaughter wears her mask with pride. But you know, Wendy, a lot of this starts at home as well. If parents sit down with their children, because we all know the foundation for learning starts at home with mentors, grandparents, aunties, uncles, cousins, whatever it is. If people sat down and really looked at the situation and say, listen, wearing a mask saves lives. If you're with someone who you don't know they're vaccinated or not, or if you're in the school system in such close proximity with others, it will save your life. And in return, we get to return to normalcy. Whatever happened to all of us wanting to go back to normalcy and not worry about the coronavirus, COVID-19?
I have one more question for you, Wendy. This one is of importance to me. Governor DeSantis has often spoken of violation of state laws and mask mandates. What is he talking about?
I don't think there's any state law that's being violated. I really don't. So, and the court ruled that in that favor too. Then the appeals court, which is of course appointed politically, ruled against it. But I honestly don't believe that there's any law being violated by mandating a mask during a pandemic.
Yeah. So for our listeners who are tuning in, we just want to let you guys know who we're speaking to. The voice that you're hearing is that of my friend Wendy DeRommel. She's the president of the Orange County Classroom Teachers Association, and we're having a really good unscripted, educational, quite informative chat about what's going on in our classrooms. So, Wendy, how do we get other people to understand that every child needs a quality education, no matter what zip code this child lives in? Because often you'll hear people talk about socialism. They talk about defunding the police. And we say to them, listen, we pay our taxes. We work as hard as we want, make as much money as we want, pay a fair share for things like public education, healthcare, the roads, postal services, law enforcement. Hell, we even pay for security in the airport. What do you? We have 2 minutes, but what can you tell those people who have an issue paying taxes to fund education, which is what we need for the next generation and the future of the United States?
Of course, because you're funding your future when you fund education. And especially, it's so disheartening to hear in the last decade even, or 2 decades in Florida, the fact that they want to divert money from public education to private and charter schools, which are not even accountable. We have to stop looking at education as a political thing and look at it as our future, because that's what it is. When you're funding education, you're funding the future.
You know, with the 30 seconds we have left, if someone wanted to contact you, can you give us a website or a contact information?
Sure. We can be contacted through orangecta@gmail.com. And that is our open CTA mailbox. It's orangecta@gmail.com.
Well, Wendy Dormel, thank you for taking the time to call in on Viewpoint with Sita and Friends. You know, I often say to folks that influence is leadership, and do the right thing even when it's not popular. And you have done the right thing for our teachers, our students, the state of Florida throughout this entire pandemic. And I thank you for it.
And I thank you for everything you do. And thank you so much for having me as a guest today.
Well, thank you so much, Wendy, for joining us. It was a fantastic segment, and we look forward to having you on someday again in the future. And thank you for listening to Viewpoint with Zita and Friends today.
We'll be right back next week.
Next Monday.
The preceding program may not necessarily reflect the views of the staff or management of WWBC.